loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we discuss the agreement to reopen the government, which does not fund Donald Trump's so-called border wall. The agreement funds the government for 3 weeks while both sides work on a possible immigration agreement. What does this mean for workers, for furloughed workers, for private contractors, and what will happen in 3 weeks? And then it's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations in the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the United States and the Taliban agreed on a draft framework for peace in Afghanistan following nearly a week of talks in Qatar. The Afghan government did not participate because the Taliban see it as illegitimate. But U.S. envoy Zalmay Khalilzad told reporters that the Taliban had agreed to never again allow the country to be a base for terrorists. The Taliban spokesman, meanwhile, said that, quote, all foreign troops must leave Afghanistan. Unquote. Next, the political crisis in Venezuela deepened over the weekend following Juan Guaido's self-proclamation as interim president. The main institutions of government remain loyal to President Nicolas Maduro, but the United States, along with allies like the UK and France, are turning up the economic pressure. What's next for Venezuela? Then, the Integrity Initiative, a UK-based group that purported to be a watchdog for what it called the Russian threat against democracy in the UK, Europe, and the US, was unmasked last year as a British intelligence-funded propaganda front group. Its website was hacked recently, and its internal documents were spread around the internet. The group has now taken the website down. And then today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country, what's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us. And finally, a new national intelligence strategy, a long-term intelligence outlook prepared by the Director of National Intelligence, says that the United States will be challenged in the coming years by nations that exploit, quote, the weakening of the post-World War II international order and dominance of Western democratic ideals and increasingly isolationist tendencies in the West, unquote. What does that mean? It means that the U.S. believes that Russia and China are its most important adversaries for the coming decades. And in other headlines, speculation is mounting that Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz will run for president next year as an independent. Schultz is a longtime Democrat and espouses centrist policies. Donald Trump tweeted in response to the speculation, quote, Howard Schultz doesn't have the guts to run for president. Watched him on 60 Minutes last night, and I agree with him that he is not the smartest person. Besides, America already has that. I only hope that Starbucks is still paying me their rent in Trump Tower, unquote. The death toll in Brazil has hit 60 in a mining disaster that took place on Friday. Almost 300 more people are unaccounted for, and officials are saying that there is little likelihood of finding any more survivors. Pressure is rising on the mining company, Vale, and some are reporting that this disaster may delay newly elected President Bolsonaro's mining deregulation plans. Bahrain's Supreme Court upheld a life sentence for opposition leader Ali Salman Ahmed Salman. Salman is accused of spying for Qatar, but human rights advocates argue that he is being persecuted for his leadership role in the opposition Al-Wefaq movement. An uprising in Bahrain was brutally crushed in 2011 with Saudi military assistance, but sporadic protests have continued. British parliamentarians will vote tomorrow on a raft of Brexit-based amendments, some of which could extend the Brexit date later than March 29th or push for a revised set of agreement terms. Sabine Wayand, deputy to EU Brexit point man Michel Barnier, said today, quote, there's no negotiation between the EU and the UK. That negotiation is finished. We are not going to reopen the withdrawal agreement, unquote. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the government reopening. President Trump and congressional leaders agreed on Friday afternoon to reopen the government for 3 weeks to give all sides time to come up with a workable federal budget, or at least that's what they say. The three-week continuing resolution does not include money for the president's so-called border wall, but it does include money to hire more Border Patrol agents. The countdown is now on to strike a major deal on immigration policy before the government shuts back down next month. We're joined from Atlanta, Georgia, by Anoa Changa. She is the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army and the host of the show, The Way with Anoa. And later in the program, we'll be joined from San Diego by Pedro Rios. He is the director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico Border Program. But let's start first with Anoa Changa. Welcome back, Anoa.
Thank you for having me.
What's your takeaway here? Trump is saying this morning or maybe last night, I don't think there's going to be a deal. Obviously, that's the beginning of a new round of negotiations. What's your take?
So as a former federal employee who survived the 2013 shutdown and having been someone who had to work for part of that time on an IOU, I mean, on the one hand, I am really thankful that this, 35 days came to an end for government workers, and hopefully their back pay will be instituted very shortly if it hasn't already. But my takeaway is that, we can't act like he's a rational human being, right? Like, he has not learned anything from what just happened. I mean, he has no care or concern for people and the harm and damage that's caused. I mean, like we were talking about before we even came on air, the subcontractors will not, unless somehow there's some magic that can happen with these different congressional bills that have been introduced by, I think, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley introduced one. And I know Ilhan Omar had introduced one related to childcare, I think. But like, unless something like that happens, there isn't going to be anything that helps subcontractors, right? So what we're going to have is we're going to have Trump doing the same thing that he does because he doesn't care. He's fixated on this wall. He wants this wall. He wants this amount of money that is actually like four times as much money was in his, budget line item anyway. And Democrats have already countered with some nonsense about a smart wall. Sounds like something out of a Black Mirror episode. but that's what we're going to see. We're going to see someone who is not going to operate in good faith on any stretch of the imagination, who has no problem letting people suffer. I think what we're really going to need is for everyone who already had planned actions to go ahead and continue putting pressure on the House and the Senate to not only pass a bill, but to make sure that, at least in terms of the Senate, that is veto proof. And that's going to be a really steep hill to climb, considering the way we watched, Mitch McConnell and the Senate act during this whole shutdown process. I mean, it took, 30 some odd days before Mitch McConnell would even let a bill be heard on the floor. That's insane. And we saw workers, actually take a stand in D.C. You all are in D.C., obviously. But then, those who have the ability to strike actually saying, like, we're going to put it on the line and we're demanding that other people join us. The flight attendants union with their president, Sarah Nelson, have been very vocal in particular about what a general strike could possibly mean. So I have no faith in Donald Trump on this one. I mean, I don't have faith in Donald Trump in anything, right? But I think that to think that, okay, these 3 weeks will be honest negotiation or honest dealing. Hopefully those who have been organizing actions around the shutdown will continue to do so and apply the pressure that is necessary to make sure that we have action that is in the best interest of the 800,000 some odd federal employees, I think it's about 1 million subcontractors nationwide, and the functionality of our supposed democracy, right? Like, I think that's what we need to be putting pressure and focusing on.
It really was the air traffic controllers who I think brought Donald Trump to his knees.
And those flight attendants.
And the flight attendants who they just weren't going to fly anymore.
Yeah, Friday morning as we were talking, all those airports were shutting down, LaGuardia.
And you see how quickly things were resolved.
And suddenly, like, hey, let's open the government.
That's right. But Noah, I want your thoughts on something. We all know Donald Trump is a narcissist, and this has really hurt him, this news coverage that he was manhandled by Nancy Pelosi, that she clearly won. He clearly lost. This has to really be under his skin. With that said, he also tends to learn from his mistakes. And I'm wondering if he's actually serious this time in his threats to use his emergency powers to build this wall. Last time it was a bargaining chip, I think. But I wonder if he now sees this as the only way that he can get this done because he just does not have the political chops to go up against Nancy Pelosi.
I think what you raise is a very strong possibility. I mean, Sarah Sanders, you know, had already like tweeted it out. I mean, but that it's the epitome of the bully that gets bested who's still, you know, sitting in a corner whining and trying to still sound strong, right? Like he's going to go ahead and declare it an emergency and use his emergency powers to do so. But as many people before me have pointed out, when you consider the fact that he had a completely different lower number, right, in terms of what he wanted appropriated for the wall, you look at that it's 30 some odd days that the shutdown happened with no wall. The fact that we are now in 2019 when Republicans have lost their majority in the House and there was never any real serious push to get the wall. Like the argument that there is an emergency falls apart every single day, right? The credibility and ability to actually make that argument. So I will admit that I'm not the best expert in what anyone can do if he decided to declare an emergency that was not an emergency. However, I do agree with you, John, that not wanting to seem like he's being bested, he would probably try and circumvent in that way. However, I'm pretty sure there probably is some other political calculation or maneuver that he's not considering because he's just not that strategic, but that it would also backfire and bite him.
We're talking with Anoa Chang about the reopening of the government. This is the first part of our first 2 hours of Loud and Clear. We're going to talk about other elements of the government shutdown and how it will impact especially immigrant families and immigrants who are seeking asylum. You know, I want to go back to something that Anoa said. She said she thought there may be a million subcontractors, federal contractors, who won't get paid back. You know, the thing is, we don't know how many federal contractors there are. Literally, no one knows. I'm looking at a story in the media. It's about this guy, Greg Seymour. He's a 62-year-old contractor with the National Park Service at Great Basin National Park. He's been out of work since December 22nd. This article came out last week. He's not going to get paid back. And then I want to read a couple sentences to you, Anoa, and it's quite remarkable. Quote, I know that the federal employees get that, meaning back pay. He says that 800,000 federal workers will get back pay even though they've been idle. But in his case, quote, since I didn't work, I won't get paid. So I'm out of luck. And so are many more of the, get this number, 4.1 million people who New York University federal workforce expert Paul Light estimates work under federal contracts. Estimates because unlike for federal employees, there is no national database tracking the number of contract employees.
That is incredible.
Right? So we could be talking actually about more than a million people. They estimate that there might be 4.1 million people in total working under federal contract. That would be federal workers on salary and private subcontractors employed under federal contract. Quite shocking.
No, and I agree. And I think that million number I might have seen in reference in an article or something like that. So, but I do appreciate that clarification because that even expands the realm of who we're actually talking about, who has been harmed by this action, right? You know, there wasn't as much conversation and chatter around this when I remember 2013, when Ted Cruz basically orchestrated the shutdown because he was a crybaby about the ACA not being repealed. And ultimately, after about 17 days or so, it ended. There wasn't as much conversation because you were looking at, I think people were getting to the point where we had just missed one check. But here, and to be clear, one check is still a lot for a lot of families, myself included. But when you were talking about here and the real serious economic detriment that being out of work does for a month, particularly if you're working in some of these lower wage, I mean, I don't even need to qualify whether regardless of what the wage is. I mean, different families and households just have different, you know, financial responsibilities. And it is very difficult, especially if you live someplace that does not have rent protections where they can just evict you for missing one time. So it is really, really serious that we not only focus on what is the political, you know, battle happening between Pelosi and Trump and McConnell, but what is the real human impact of all of this stuff, not just on, you know, furloughed federal employees and those who are working under the IOUs, but also, you know, subcontractors, as we've been assessing, and even small businesses, the businesses that serve, you know, federal buildings, et cetera. are also employing people in these communities who are probably suffering because of lack of business. And if you're a smaller business and you're cutting people's hours or you're cutting people or whatever the case may be, and just the ripple effect that we're not discussing, that doesn't get discussed, is really discouraging. And there is no safety net for these people. You know, you had different governments, different state governments, I think, starting to be pressured to allow folks to apply for like emergency unemployment. But I remember in 2013, we were told we didn't qualify for unemployment because we were still technically employed. But when you're in this prolonged state of non-employment and non-pay status, how does that work? So there is a lot policy-wise that needs to be looked at once folks get past this current hurdle of getting things funded and avoiding another shutdown that should not wait until the next shutdown occurs. Because 6 years ago, we had a shutdown. 5.5 years ago, we had a shutdown. It was October 2013. We had a shutdown, and all this conversation we're having now, if people had actually really examined some of these problematic, you know, ways in which the government operates, could have been addressed before now. And so this does not need to be an afterthought for the next time when families might have to suffer.
Noah, I want to ask you about a sort of a side story that came out of this whole budget crisis. And that is the notion that some of these private contractors are dropping healthcare programs for their employees because in the event of a shutdown, they just can't afford to pay for the programs. Do you see this as an excuse to get out of some of these high costs? And do you think that this is going to be a factor in what might be a follow-on shutdown in 3 weeks?
I mean, I think it could definitely be a factor. I don't know if it's an excuse. I think for smaller, you know, especially when we're talking about smaller businesses, I think there are hard decisions that people make. And because of the way we have outside influences and factors that are being applied, that we have some scenarios where there probably are people who are making tough decisions who don't necessarily want to make them. I think in terms of like larger entities and corporations who may make certain decisions and use this as an excuse, I think, you know, you're spot on there. But when we're looking at what's happening going forward, I mean, these are all considerations that we need to be actively advocating, that members of Congress, particularly these progressives that we're super, super excited about, who are pushing, that we not only continue to push them to make sure that they're putting forth legislation to address these issues, but that we're also holding them up and supporting them when they are actually standing and towing the line. And like I said, like I believe it's Ayanna Pressley, who is the one that is pushing for back pay for private contractors. Or I don't know if she's the only one, but I believe I saw something from her about that. So, you know, this type of stuff are things that people are starting to put forth and think about, and we need to support them and make sure it moves.
That was the voice of Anoa Changa. She joined us from Atlanta. She is the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army and the host of the show, The Way with Anoa. Now we're joined from San Diego by Pedro Rios. He is the director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico Border Program. Pedro, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be on the show again.
Pedro, let me ask you this all-important question, especially for the immigrant rights community and advocates for immigrant rights. Trump, when he tried to reopen the government and have a new deal, promised if the Democrats would accept $5.7 billion allocated for the wall, that he would grant relief for the Dreamers DACA recipients, young kids who came with their parents without legal documents and still don't have legal documents, and also the TPS, those who had been given temporary protective status, that included Haitians and others whose TPS has been revoked by the Trump administration. Do you think that as part of a new deal for an enduring resolution on the budget, that the immigrant rights community or the Democrats will accept some sort of deal whereby some of these communities get relief from the threat of deportation in exchange for a border wall?
You know, what I'm hearing from, especially from Dreamers who live along border communities, is that they are unwilling to accept that trade-off. I'm also hearing from some large networks of the TPS who are also saying that they're unwilling to accept the trade-off that places at risk other people's lives for their own. And so, and I think it's important what you alluded to is that a lot of these programs, the TPS, the DACA, were programs that already existed and that were eliminated essentially by Donald Trump's administration. And so he essentially is offering something that was already in place. So my hope is that the Democrats don't take the bait, that they don't take this, because it's really a Trojan horse. The the TPS is only for people from Latin American countries. It doesn't include people from African countries. And so there's also a divide and conquer strategy here that I believe the administration is trying to implement. And then finally, the last point that I think is significant, this idea that those who are seeking asylum, especially children, can seek asylum from their own countries. It's just absurd. Many of them are leaving their countries because of dangerous, volatile situations, and to expect for them to apply for asylum in their home countries and wait there while the danger hasn't subsided, it's just not a realistic way of understanding how migration happens and why people have a need to leave their countries because of violence.
John, I think Pedro is completely right about that. And, you know, people are been criticizing Trump for, quote, hostage taking with these immigrants who had relief. They were exempted from a deportation under the Obama administration. Trump gratuitously, unnecessarily, cruelly took that back from these people. And now he's saying, but guess what? I'll give you this. I'll give you the relief back from these unnecessary, awful deportation threats in exchange for people giving me money for
temporarily.
Temporarily. In exchange for people giving me money for a wall that's completely, again, absolutely unnecessary because there is no crisis. Pedro, let's talk about what was the essential fundamental issue in this government shutdown, which was Donald Trump's demand for $5.7 billion to, quote, build the wall at the U.S.-Mexican border. Again, Trump is suggesting that unless there is more money allocated for such a wall, in the new, after the continuing resolution expires in a couple of weeks, he's prepared to shut the government down again or to take emergency actions and use his emergency authority to fund the wall using other funds that would be available to him under those circumstances. Let's just help the broad audience here understand, is there an emergency?
Absolutely not. Not the sort of emergency that Donald Trump and the White House have been trying to paint along the border. And we can look at different activities that they have done to try to create that false narrative of an emergency. That includes, for instance, the increased aggression against migrants by shooting tear gas and chemical agents at them. This is tear gas that has been outlawed in wars and different types of conflicts between nation states. The metering system, which means not taking in migrants as they should and slowing down the process, which places them in greater danger. The closing of the ports of entry for their readiness exercises in order to show a great amount of force and to collectively punish the border communities. And the presence of the military, obviously, which creates a lot more tension in border communities. So the crisis is really a crisis of despair for Trump, who is trying to create a make-believe story that is not consistent with the reality that we have in terms of our communities here in San Diego and elsewhere, San Diego being the second safest large city of populations of over 500,000 people, according to the FBI statistics.
Pedro, I've been looking at media reports from people. These are reporters who have gone to the U.S.-Mexican border at different towns. The towns, actually, the people who live around them, they don't want these big, ugly cement or steel barriers. They say there is no crisis. And in fact, it's very obstructive and very inhibitive because a lot of border towns have sister cities right across the border, either in the United States or in Mexico, and they rely on each other.
In addition to the fact that the federal government is planning to take by eminent domain a lot of privately owned land, people's farmland, grazing land, whatever it is, to build this wall on. They're going to divide people's personal land holdings.
That's correct. And we've seen communities throughout the border lands that have passed resolutions, so cities passing resolutions against construction of more border walls. We've seen a letter by a number of sheriffs from border communities sent to the White House last week, essentially saying the same thing, that walls don't work. And walls perpetuate a situation where migrants have to cross through much more dangerous terrain where walls can't be built, and that's where we've seen an increase of deaths. And then there is border wall infrastructure in communities where you have $1 million wall built around communities where they barely even have running water going to their homes. And so there is a clash of reality that we're seeing here. One this manufactured belief and crisis by the White House, and two, what people are living on the ground and rejecting the notion of border walls. And if we look at just 10, 15 years ago, when President Bush attempted to build walls, and he did through eminent domain, a lot of that land ended up essentially stuck in the courts because of lawsuits. So it will be very difficult for Trump and his administration to actually get a hold of the land once it gets locked up in lawsuits.
We're joined from San Diego by Pedro Rios. He's the director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico Border Program, and he's also chairperson of the San Diego Immigrant Rights Consortium. Pedro, do you think that this budget fight is over, that Donald Trump has lost, or do you think that we've just gotten through phase one and we're going to go into another similar fight?
I think we are facing another similar fight precisely because Donald Trump ended up with a black eye after this first round and got a couple of weeks to consider what his next options are, which he is threatening now to declare a national emergency in order to get funds from the Department of Defense. We know that that could face legal challenges as well. And unfortunately, he made a promise to his small base of supporters that now he feels he needs to come through with. And it's a promise that is detrimental not only for border communities, but when it involves a government shutdown, we see that the impact in billions of dollars affects people all over the country.
I think the real crisis, John, is the fact that the United States does have a broken immigration system. There are at least 14 million people who are undocumented in the United States. The number may be more than that. The fact of the matter is undocumented workers go to work, they pay taxes, they're essential to the overall economy. Businesses know that if these 14 million people were deported, as Donald Trump said he wanted to deport everybody, not only would it create immense human suffering for them and their families, it would actually devastate the U.S. economy. So when you strip all of this away, when you get down to the reality of the fact that the United States economy is in fact dependent in large measure on immigrant labor, including the labor of undocumented immigrant people, when you strip the rhetoric away, strip it away and look at the facts, you can't but come to the conclusion that this part of the population has been targeted not because of some grave menace that it poses to the United States. It's just the purest, rank, crass opportunism by politicians who don't even believe their own rhetoric. They know. It's like, Pedro, it's like when Donald Trump said, well, whenever I was having low energy at my rallies, I would just start to chant, build a wall, because the energy would go up. I mean, it was this kind of simple Hitler-like sort of a manipulation of large crowds, again, just to, quote, get energy back. And yet it's not just about energy, because there are real human beings and real communities that are so profoundly affected.
Pedro, I want to ask you, too. There's a Republican congressman in Texas. He represents Texas's 23rd congressional district. It's an 875-mile-long border that he represents. His name is Will Hurd, and he's one of very few Republicans who have come out and said, this is a manufactured crisis. There is no crisis. We don't need a border wall. Are there other Republicans like him who are going to go public in this next round of negotiations, or is Will Hurd standing alone?
I think right now Will Hurd is standing alone, unfortunately, though my hope is that other Republicans have seen the impact and the threat of shutdown of the airports, for instance, and even federal employees who are prohibited from engaging in any sort of protest, the threat of them doing that, the call from various legislators for them to take action is important, because I think once we begin seeing mobilization by those who are not supposed to take mobilization and say, hey, you know, this is affecting my family, this is affecting my ability to live in a way that upholds my basic dignity, then my hope is that other Republicans will take heed and will listen to someone like Representative Hurd and say, you know, he lives in the border, he should know. We shouldn't treat them as provincial lands, wild, wild west. There are actually 15 million people that live in border communities from San Diego to Brownsville, and we should really take heed to what they're saying. And so my hope is that as this, the next couple of weeks round out, that there's much more common sense in how the Republican Party is thinking of how they're going to respond to the badness coming out of the White House.
Pedro, 30 seconds left. Take us out, if you would.
Yeah, I think the Democrats have to absolutely hold the line. I know a lot of people's lives and jobs are at risk, but all of our lives are at risk as well. We can't afford to continue militarizing the border, whether it's through border walls or other sorts of enforcement matters. And we have to look at a much more longer range perspective here. Is 3 years enough for TPS protection or DACA protection? Or do we deserve as a community much more long-term protection? I think that should guide the decision-making coming out of D.C.
That was the voice of Pedro Rios. He is the director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico Border Program. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa. This is a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, good to be back. I missed you all last week for the holiday.
That is so true, but we're glad you're back now. Chris, let's start. We have a number of categories. We're going to go over stories that all technology related, some of which have to do with privacy in the surveillance state, some have to do with law enforcement issues, some corporate surveillance, including university surveillance of college prospects, artificial intelligence and robots. There's a lot to talk about. Let's get started.
Wow. So the first story I wanted to bring up this week was first back in May of 2018, the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, sent a FOIA, Freedom of Information request, to the FBI asking for any records related to surveillance of people's social media accounts. The FBI has finally gotten back to them. And to quote their response, please be advised that upon reviewing the substantive nature of your request, we can neither confirm nor deny the existence of records.
There you have it.
Yeah, there you have it. For me personally, and you know, maybe John has an opinion about this, when they say neither confirm nor deny, that pretty much confirms it, but they're not ready to release it or talk about it.
That's called a Glomar response.
Yes, yes, exactly. Unfortunately, we know that the FBI and other law enforcement agencies, in conjunction with federal agencies, do monitor social media. They do it in high-tech ways. They do it in low-tech ways, meaning that they just kind of keep track of Facebook pages. We saw that a few months ago when there were those terrible fires and explosions in, I believe it was Lowell, Massachusetts, where the Massachusetts State Police said that they were tracking, they had bookmarks of some activist sites on their computers. But this one, specifically about the FBI, we already know the FBI contracts with a company called Penlink, which is a big data analytics firm that they say it provides software to parse and analyze social media data. So if the FBI isn't monitoring this, why do they have a contract with Penlink and other contracts with companies like Dataminer that they use at their fusion centers? Now, these fusion centers are regional headquarters to coordinate between the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and other national agencies for monitoring what's going on in that region. We already also know that FBI has monitored the anti-war movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, and so many more. So the ACLU has actually filed a lawsuit now in response to this. It's probably going to take a significant amount of time for this to go through, but I'm excited to watch what comes out of this lawsuit and how much the ACLU is able to get a judge to compel the FBI to confirm.
This is an ongoing battle, too, between the ACLU and other groups that support civil liberties and the federal government. We need to accept the fact that the federal government will not concede anything. It will constantly try to nibble away at our civil liberties because that's the nature of the beast. So it's not just the ACLU that we need to support. It's all these different lawsuits. It's all these different groups. Otherwise, we're going to end up not having any access to information that is legitimately ours.
And again, when we talk about the Glomar response from law enforcement, which goes back to a CIA case in the mid-1970s,
that's right.
But again, there are important records that have been obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. I was working as a volunteer supporting the efforts of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, the PCJF, and they did a FOIA request about whether the FBI was monitoring the Occupy movement between September 2011 and when it basically was broken up by a coordinated federal local law enforcement attack, which happened a couple months later. Now, during that time, 7,000 people were arrested. 7,000. I'm just thinking about it when I was thinking about Venezuela, because here we have violent protests against the government, and 350 people have been arrested in the last week. And U.S. media is howling about the fact that 350 people have been arrested. The U.S. law enforcement agencies arrested 7,000 peaceful protesters in the Occupy movement in 2 months. In one case in New York City on the Brooklyn Bridge on October 1st, 2011, 700 were arrested, trapped on the bridge and arrested, people who had no idea that they were about to be arrested. They were not engaging in civil disobedience. So the PCJF, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, filed this public records request, and there was a trove of documents, and I think they were released on Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve, because a bunch of people spent all day Christmas going through those records, and what they showed is that the FBI, in coordination with local law enforcement and also private corporations through the so-called fusion centers, well, not so-called, they are fusion centers, created after 2011, that exist all over the country, they were monitoring everything about the Occupy movement, including the Facebook posts of all of the occupants and the posts of those who were using Facebook to promote stuff that was going on in Occupy. So like one of the documents says, Occupy Boston is hosting something for Noam Chomsky, I think. That was in 2011, a seminar about Noam Chomsky. And then as the sort of FBI sort of documentation goes on, the reporting back to central headquarters, it's like the Facebook event has 22 likes. Now it has 34 likes. Now it has 59 likes. There are so many people interested. So many people are going. You know, like this meticulous evaluation of Facebook posts related to people engaged in First Amendment protected activities.
That's right. You know, on that note, this goes well before Facebook, too, on the digital realm. In 2004, I and many, many others protested the Republican National Convention in New York City. This is, you know, the George W. Bush era. He was extremely unpopular at that point with the war in Iraq and everything else going on. And I was actually arrested by the NYPD, among many, many others. And in the lawsuit that I was part of after that, there was a class action suit. We found out that the NYPD and federal agencies were also monitoring websites. At that time, these things called info shops, you know, kind of regional autonomous centers were being monitored. Their websites were being monitored as well. This goes, you know, well before social media as we know it today. And of course, well, you know, before that as well in so many movements.
Yeah, the same thing happened with the January 20th defendants, remember?
Absolutely right.
The police insisted on getting the information on anyone who had visited different websites before the January 20th anti-Trump counter-inaugural protests, and they were given access.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of continue on this conversation, but from a different angle. You've sent us, Chris, an article from TechCrunch, which I've become a big fan of, and they're about these accursed license plate readers that law enforcement organizations across the country have. It turns out that they are not at all secure, that frequently when the police departments take possession of them, they don't change the passwords. They come with these default passwords, and they frequently leak on the internet. And what they're leaking is information about you and your daily routine. They'll track you from point A to point B to point C, and essentially lay out where you're going, who you're seeing, how long you're there, when you return. It's information that ought to be kept private. Really, it's information that falls under the category of mass surveillance, and certainly surveillance without a warrant.
Yeah, it is mass surveillance, you know, and they say that they're using these primarily to, you know, give you a ticket or tow your car if you owe too much money or you have a registration issue or whatnot. But yes, this is mass surveillance because they're tracking and keeping information on where where your car was found. So, you know, for example, this goes back actually to 2015 when the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is another one of these organizations, you know, on top of the ACLU and the PCJF and Lucy Parsons Lab and so many others that people should be monitoring, you know, or watching for these, you know, developments. But in 2015, the EFF said they found dozens of these exposed devices in Boston. TechCrunch, 3 years later, found more than 150 of these license plate readers from multiple manufacturers connected to the internet. And it's not hard to do this. You can actually, there are websites where you can go and search for devices with specific characteristics. None of this is illegal, by the way. It's totally legal. If it's out on the internet, you can find it. TechCrunch notes that they didn't use any of the passwords because that would actually be unlawful to get into a system you don't have permission to get into, but it's perfectly legal to find them. So Dave Moss from the EFF says, it doesn't surprise us to hear that the problems are still ongoing, which is like such an understatement, I think. You know, certainly understand where he's coming from, but these cameras, if they can be found and the databases can be found by pretty much anyone on the internet, then it's extremely likely that somebody could use that information to track you. So not just the police tracking you, but, you know, one of the things that we always want to, that I always think about is, what about somebody trying to escape a domestic violence situation or another, you know, hostile home environment? If their abuser could get into these systems, you know, they could find out where this person is theoretically, if they haven't changed their license plate, which we know, you know, it can be a difficult and costly, you know, proposition depending on your state DMV.
It absolutely does. And, you know, when it's coupled with other modes, other methods of mass surveillance, they can find out a lot about you. You know, it's just like the argument about the use of metadata. We've talked about this on the show in the past. Metadata, a lot of people think is just, you know, just meaningless numbers. It's not meaningless numbers. What if you're calling an abortion clinic? What if you're calling a secret boyfriend or girlfriend? It can essentially lay out an outline of your life just by the phone numbers that you dial. Well, it's similar with this case. Just by showing where you drive and when you do that driving, you can lay out a skeleton of a person's life. And it's just simply not fair.
Not just a person's life and where they go, but who they could potentially be affiliated with, or through just the fact that the data is aggregated, people that happen to be around them, but that they aren't affiliated with. So if you regularly go to a coffee shop or something like that, and somebody who then commits a crime also goes in the neighborhood of that coffee shop, well, your car and their car are there about the same time regularly for whatever reason it is, but then you could be caught up in some sort of dragnet just because you happen to be in the same area.
Absolutely right. This is not relegated solely to governments. We can go on to the next article. This is Engadget. It's not just governments. It's Microsoft, Facebook, Google, Amazon, Apple. Everybody is collecting data on us, and that data can show what kind of lives we lead.
That's right. Well, this specific story about Microsoft, you know, Microsoft makes, in addition to Windows, they make the Edge web browser. But one of the things they're doing on their mobile version of that browser is going to be to start, just like Facebook and Google have been doing, telling you which articles are so-called fake news. So, you know, they're going to do that when you go to a website, right? They're going to say, hey, this, you know, this website is fake news. They might say, you know, that it regularly corrects or clarifies errors or that it doesn't. One of their other marks is that it avoids deceptive headlines or discloses ownership and financing. But one of the major issues with this particular implementation of it is who they're partnering with to do this. They're using an organization called NewsGuard. Now, if you go to NewsGuard's website and look at their advisory board, I'm just going to list off some names here. Tom Ridge, the first Secretary of Homeland Security. General Michael Hayden, former director of the CIA, former director of the NSA.
He knows something about fake news, John.
Oh boy, does he.
You know, and so many more, you know, former White House communications director Don Baer, Elise Jordan, the former speechwriter for Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice.
Wait a second. Wow. They're checking about whether something's fake news. The speechwriter for Condoleezza Rice. Can we go back to 2002? And with the speeches about the mushroom clouds and Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and all those great Condoleezza Rice speeches. Wait a second. A million Iraqis are dead. Thousands of Americans are dead. Tens of thousands of Americans have life-changing wounds because these people lied, including Condoleezza Rice, who and her speechwriter, because it was her speeches along with Rumsfeld and Cheney. And anyway, they're the guard. They're the ones who are going to filter out fake news.
Yeah, this is the advisory board of NewsGuard. So just like when we talk about Facebook with the Atlantic Council, which is just a NATO think tank, we have to be paying attention to all of these other companies that are popping up, NewsGuard being one of them, that Google and Facebook and Microsoft and others are going to use. Now, in this particular case, as a web developer, I can see what browsers people use to go to the websites I manage. Almost no one uses the Microsoft Edge mobile browser, but you can be certain that this is going to be coming to the, you know, browsers that you use every day. This is just a test, and they're going to be bringing it to the browsers that we use every day. For example, Microsoft Edge on a computer, maybe Chrome, maybe Safari, who knows? Firefox has talked about this, and right now they're not implementing something like this, and pressure needs to be kept on by the community to make sure that they don't.
In the name of hunting fake news, you have a kind of full spectrum takeover of people's social media accounts, again, targeting alternative media by the people who routinely, and I would say professionally, lie to people about what's at stake, say, in Iraq or now in Venezuela. Yeah, this is really something. And again, you know, just create a name, John. It's called NewsGuard.
Yeah, exactly.
Brought to you by Condoleezza Rice's speechwriter, NewsGuard.
And Michael Hayden. Unbelievable. But this is where we've come.
Let's go on to the next story, because it's also...
It gets worse now with this next story.
I read the next story this morning on the Metro. By the way, it's harder to get a seat again on the Metro now that the government has reopened. That's the downside of the reopening. But I thought this was pretty stunning, especially for parents of teenagers or teenagers themselves. Kind of a very, very important story. Let's go ahead.
Yeah, wow. This story, I read it this morning, and I almost couldn't believe it. But then, you know, almost none of this is truly unbelievable at this point. Colleges are actually using how long you spend on their website, how many links you click in the emails they send you, and even how quickly you open the email they send you as part of the signals to determine whether or not they should accept you to the college. So they use some examples here: Boston University, Seton Hall, Quinnipiac College, which is, you know, right up here in Connecticut, and Dickinson College. So they can see when they send you an email, how quickly do you open that email? How much time do you spend on their website? And through tracking, they can identify who you are specifically through that email or from your application or request just for more information about the college. When we, you know, you might go and click send me information about the application process. From that moment on, they know who you are because you've put in your address and phone number and email and all of that. And they can see what they're calling this is demonstrated interest in that university. How much time, again, do you spend on the website? And they have 80 different variables that they're using, you know, to determine this. I think this is such an invasion of privacy, and people have different ways of being interested in a university. Some people go to go and grab paper booklets, at a college fair or something like that. I think there's also a class component to this. If you're a student in high school and you're working, you know, multiple jobs and you're studying to keep your GPA up as well, you might not have time to just browse the website of the college that you want to attend. So there are privacy implications to this, but also class implications when it comes to applying to these schools. They say these are not the only way that obviously that they're, you know, applying, you know, that they're monitoring, you know, figuring out who to accept into the schools, but it is certainly some of the signal that they're using in addition to jobs and in addition to your high school records and SAT scores and all of that.
Again, let's just remember this is, now that the story has come out that they're, quote, quietly surveilling the prospective college applicants, now that it's come out, they're saying, well, this is to prove demonstrated interest. Because let's say a high school student applies at five different colleges and they want to see, did you click on ours quickly? Did you spend time on our link so that we show that you have a demonstrated, real, genuine, authentic interest in going to our college? That's what they say is the reason. But there could be surveilling all kinds of other things on kids' social media. Like, sure, it matters to them what they do. Now also, This was obviously a secret surveillance program, because now that it's not secret, this would be a very easy system to game. Let's say you really wanted to get into College X. So you apply and they send you a link back. Now, if you know how the system works, you click it like instantly and you don't go off for 18 hours.
That's
like
right.
You're just that, you have that kind of demonstrated interest, or your parents know how to game the system. So obviously it's an easy system to game from people in the know. That means it would not have relevance if it was publicly known, which means it only has relevance for the university if it is, in fact, a secret surveillance program. Anyway, that's my conspiratorial take on it. What do you think?
I actually agree with what you're saying. And, you know, it's not just even that you can open the link and leave it open for 18 hours, because they're going to track how often you click to a new page. They can track down to, if you, you know, just click on the page and drag some text around because you fidget when you're looking at a web page, they can track when you scroll on it. So, yeah, it absolutely could be gamed, but they have found so many ways. And by they, I just mean data mining, advertising, this whole industry has found so many ways just to track what people are actually doing on their websites. Sometimes they use it to determine whether you're human or not. I've definitely been flagged as not human. It's a little offensive.
We should apply these standards to Mike Hayden and Condoleezza
yes,
Rice's speechwriters about the not human part. John, how many schools do you think do this?
It's early in the game, but I'm going to say probably half.
According to this report from the National Association of College Admissions Counseling, 37% of the 493 schools. So you were close.
It'll be half by next year.
So that's buried down in the article. In the beginning of the article, we hear about a few colleges like Boston University, et cetera, et cetera. It's 37%. That means this is going to be a thing. Now the other schools are finding out, and they're like, hey, we're the other 63%. We should do this too. When you think, I know we're going to do technology tip at the end of the day, but if you think about like juniors, seniors in high school, or even freshmen and sophomore, kids do all sorts of weird stuff online, right? It's a thing. They're not thinking, oh, how is this going to, when you're 13 years old and you're a freshman in high school, you're not thinking, hey, I wonder how this will play out in terms of college admissions when I'm 17 or 18. But should students, should their parents, should their families be aware that what kids do when they're 13, 14 could actually be part of a sort of a surveillance operation by universities who are trying to pick the right students?
They absolutely should. And I think this gets to a bigger picture. And I want to skip down this list of articles we're looking at, Brian, to this piece in The Economist by musician and entertainer Will.i.am. He has his own solo career. He's also with the Black Eyed Peas. It's a very interesting article, and I will link this on Twitter later on for folks to check out, where he starts talking about, you know, attending the World Economic Forum, and the chairman of Salesforce turned to him and said, "Identity, a combination of identity and data, and how they're increasingly intertwined." And Will.i.am, he makes some really good points here about how data is being used specifically, you know, to monitor us, to track us, to target us. But I really appreciate, if I can, I'm going to read just this one paragraph. "Despite dark cinematic visions of a future hijacked by algorithms, I am an optimist that AI and data can contribute to society. It is time to focus on doing what is moral, fair, and right. I challenge today's data monarchs and the next generation of leaders to put their energies into data and AI that serve humanity first, instead of designing platforms bent on controlling humanity with money as the primary goal." I love that term, data monarchs, by the way. I think that's a great term and we should use it more often. And I appreciate the sentiment that he's coming from. You know, there are certain things that I don't agree with in this piece, but I do want everyone to go read it. I think it's a really fantastic piece that folks should go spend some time reading and thinking about. And he basically calls for us to own our data as a human right and to be compensated for it.
Chris Garafa is our guest. Chris is a technologist. We talk to him every Monday in this segment called Technology Rules. Wow, time is really going fast. We have five minutes left. I'm looking at this other story. I think it's another story. Social media can predict what you'll say, even if you don't participate.
Oh, yeah. So I wanted to clarify. I saw a lot of interesting summaries of this study, and I went back and read the study. So what this is saying, that based on who is around you in your social media network, the people that you follow or follow you or the people that you're friends with, even if you stop using your account, you can actually, there's a solid chance that an algorithm could figure out what you would say in a specific situation on social media. I've seen some people reading this as saying that even if you don't have an account, they could figure it out. That's not the case. This is specifically about if you have an account, they can use who you're connected to figure it out. Because, you know, we are all influenced by our peers. We are influenced by those around us. And in turn, we influence them. But this kind of data analysis is something that could be used not just by scientists and people interested in this research, but it could be used by marketing companies. And it could be used by the surveillance state to also target people, not for doing something, but for, you know, thought crime or future crime, things that they might do sometime in the future.
Well, have you looked at this story, John?
I mean, it's the first I've heard of it, was when Chris put it here in the list.
I mean, I'm just looking at to see how these concepts worked in the world of social media. The researchers turned to a database of about 14,000 Twitter users who collectively produced more than 30 million tweets. Within this, they identified 927 users and the 15 users each of them most frequently interacted with. Their history of those interactions were ingested into an algorithm that measured the predictability of future word use given what happened in the past. So they're able, by developing these patterns and then the algorithms that match it and look for it, actually be able to have a significant success rate at predicting what your next words would be based on speech patterns.
Just crazy. And dangerous.
Yeah, very dangerous. And, you know, I'm sure that there are people already looking at how to use this research, how to use this algorithm for all the wrong ways. This is just what big data gets us.
Chris, we only have like a minute and a half left. We should probably go to the tech tip. And it's actually something that I've been thinking about and worried about. And that is how to check if your passwords have been compromised. I don't have any idea how I know if my password's been compromised.
Well, here's how you know. There's a website, haveibeenpwned.com. And I'll also throw this link out on Twitter later on so people can see. It's haveibeenpwned.com. You put your email address in and it tells you, have you been found on any leaked sites? And you can subscribe and then go see, once you confirm that you control that email address, which websites your information has been leaked in. So I looked at mine. I've been in, Adobe, Discus, Dropbox, Gawker, and many, many others, because I've been on the internet for a long time. This is inevitable. And when you do that, just go change your password at that service. And don't use the same password for multiple services. And you can actually sign up to get an email notification every time your email is found in a new data dump.
You know, I just did it on mine, and I have been compromised. And it gives you the date. I was compromised on the 24th of June, 2018 at 6:17 in the morning.
Go change all your passwords now, John.
Now I got to change all my Doug Hunt passwords. And that's my private email. That's not the one that I put on my website. Good grief.
Well, to clarify, there's nothing you did wrong. It's when these companies get hacked and the data is released. This is what happens.
Good grief. I'm looking at my public email now, just out of curiosity. Oh, boy. 1, 2, 3, 4 different. No. It gives you not. There were 19 of them. It has them all listed here. And there are things I've never heard of. KMO.MOE, credential stuffing, whatever that is.
We're gonna pursue this next week.
We are
completely out of time. John Kiriakou is stunned right now.
I'm
He's
stunned.
Staggering. He's walking out of the studio because he can't believe it. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. He joins us every Monday in this segment of Loud and Clear called Technology Rules, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.